Welcome to Trailblazers, where we explore the inspiring journeys of entrepreneurs and industry leaders who are redefining success and making a lasting impact. These game changers are driving progress in our region and around the world. I'm Melody Bradford, your host. Welcome to Trailblazers. In this episode, I'm joined by a leader, innovator, and risk taker who didn't just follow the road ahead, he designed it. Today's guest quite literally helped shape what the world drives. Ed Welburn is a design legend, the former vice president of global design at General Motors, the first African-American to lead global design at a major automaker, and the creative force behind some of the most recognizable vehicles on the road. During his tenure, GM Design influenced icons across Cadillac, Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, and beyond, redefining performance, luxury, and identity on a global scale. Ed, welcome to Trailblazers. Wow, it's an honor to have you.
This is great. I love that introduction.
I try to do my research. Ed, I want to talk to you about what first sparked your passion for cars and design. I remember being at your home and seeing a book, right,
yes,
where there was a little car that was drawn that,
yes,
your mom kept. Tell me a little bit about, you know, what sparked your passion for design and ultimately car design.
You know, it's a good question. What sparked my interest? I mean, I, you know, when other toddlers were drawing stick figures of horses and people and houses, I was drawing cars. I mean, just as a toddler, I was drawing cars. And why cars? You know, it's kind of interesting, but it stuck with me. I drew them everywhere, including inside my mother's books. She wasn't very happy about that, but but that's where it all started. And yeah, I went to the auto show, Philadelphia Auto Show. I think I was 8 years old, and fell in love with a concept car. And I said, you know, to my parents right then and there, I was 8 years old, when I grew up, I want to design cars for that company.
Wow. So you knew pretty early on then.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt.
Well, you're known for helping shape some of GM's most iconic vehicles. When people hear your name, what designs or vehicles do you most hope they associate your legacy? Which ones have you worked on?
Well, you know, I've worked on so many. I mean, I'm told that I've worked on over 540 design projects.
Wow.
But, you know, what I want to be known for, first off, being known for designing Cadillacs, being known for designing three generations of Corvette, designing Camaro, designing the Bumblebee Camaro for Transformers.
Yes.
You know, that is great to be known for.
Oh,
that.
Yeah.
It really is. I like being known for creating an environment in which designers just felt free to create,
mm-hmm,
and just having a culture within GM Design that was really building.
And we're going to get into, you know, kind of the team that you led, mm-hmm, ultimately and how that evolved. But you've led design efforts connected to vehicles like Cadillac's modern renaissance, including bold, expressive designs that changed the brand's trajectory. What was it like to design during such a transformational era, not just from Cadillac's perspective, but maybe others?
Well, you know, that's a fascinating question because, you know, when you're doing that, the challenge is, you know, how people in other areas of the business, marketing, sales, communications, all of them, how will they accept the change that you're proposing or that you're deeply involved in? It's one thing if it's a brand that's not doing well and you're trying to fix it at times,
mm-hmm,
everyone wants to help, and that really is not helpful when everyone wants to give you a hand. And then there are those brands that are very successful, but you recognize it's time for a change, and they're very reluctant to make a change because they think everything's rolling just fine.
If it isn't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. If it isn't broke, don't fix it. But yeah, you can kind of see in the future some change needs to happen. That's a challenge.
Yeah, and you must have had to work cross-functionally across multiple teams and, mm-hmm, to a degree, make everyone happy, but not so much.
And the thing is, our real partners are engineering, you know, because I'm on the design side. You know, my team is what makes it look pretty. They're the ones that make it function. We don't necessarily speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge challenge to get designers and engineers to work together for the common good, which is the car.
They speak different languages, for sure.
Really,
I imagine that happens in construction, too. And I may know the answer to this question, but of all the projects that you've worked on or overseen, what was the most interesting or creatively challenging vehicle and why? And I'm going to venture to guess to say that even if it isn't the most interesting of all of them that you've done, I do want to hear a little bit about the Beast, which is essentially the presidential limo and some of the challenges that you face from that perspective.
Well, yeah, the designing the Beast, the presidential limousine, was a great honor, and it was an incredible challenge, both in the design of the vehicle and how we designed it. There's so much security around that project that I had a very secret studio that even most of my own employees, my staff, did not know where it was.
Wow.
It was a select team that I put together along with Secret Service, and we worked in this very secret studio on this vehicle. And we designed it in a very different way than the presidential limousines had ever been done in the past. And because of the increased amount of armor plating in the vehicle, you know, the vehicles, because they used to use a regular limousine, add all this armor, and it kept making the interior smaller and smaller as the armor plating got thicker and thicker.
Sure.
So our whole approach was, let's start with the interior of a limousine and go out. And that's why it's big. It's a beast. And it was Secret Service that gave it the nickname the Beast. And it stuck. And hey, I'm very proud of the project. I'm proud of the result.
And what administration was that?
The first Beast, because I worked on two generations.
Okay.
The first one was for Obama, and he used it. His inauguration was the first time it was seen publicly.
Okay.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah,
too.
Absolutely.
That was very, very cool.
And the second
Beast was, that was at the end of Obama. So he used it. And then the first administration of Donald Trump used it. And then Biden has used the second generation. You know, they're usually used for about 8 years. And it takes years to build them.
Yeah.
And then they're in service for quite a few years.
Yeah. And if I recall correctly, you had mentioned to me at one point that there were certain things that you didn't even know that you had to allow for from a design perspective.
There are certain things in that vehicle that to this day I do not know what they were. You know, you'd have engineering drawings that were very detailed. Then there'd be areas of the drawings that just blacked out.
Mm.
And I'd say, well, you know, what is that? Can we move that maybe a few millimeters to help us in shaping the front of the vehicle? What is that? And I would just get, there was a look that Secret Service would give me.
That's it.
And it was like, well, okay. So we were, you know, and so sometimes we're able to move that black area, wouldn't know what was in it, but we had to just work around it.
Yeah, non-negotiable. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any other projects that, you know?
So that was good. And using that same secret studio, which was referred to as Studio X, is where we developed Camaro and the Bumblebee for Transformers, the Bumblebee Camaro. We developed it there. And
were those designs embargoed then? Were they, you know, top secret?
Everything
from a Hollywood perspective? Okay.
Everything is.
Yeah.
But that one in particular, and Chevrolet wanted me, they knew I was working on a secret Camaro project that even they hadn't seen.
Yeah.
And so we're developing that as a concept car for the auto show, this Camaro. And I said, well, could you show it to Michael Bay? You know, Michael Bay's looking for a vehicle to be Bumblebee for his movie.
Yeah.
So I said, well, if he tells me about the movie, I'll show him the car. And Michael Bay said, if he shows me the car, I'll tell him about the movie.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was back and forth. But I admit, I gave in.
Yeah.
And I showed him the car we're developing as a concept vehicle. And I showed him, I also have a vintage Camaro that's yellow with black stripes. And I showed him that. And he was convinced, well, this is Bumblebee. This is it. And
that was easy.
Yeah. And He and I ended up working together quite a bit on all the Transformer movies, or at least the first five. And for each one, he would come visit me first after we really got to know each other. And we would walk the studios looking for different vehicles to be in the movie. Mm-hmm. And we would update Bumblebee for each one. And then we'd add other cars as well. So it was a great working relationship. For the fourth movie, he wanted to thank me, and I had a speaking part.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah. We'll have to look out for that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned this Transformer correlation. I mean, did you have to basically, I imagine AI kind of took over, or some element that kind of transformed it, no pun intended, right?
Yeah. Well, see,
or pun intended, rather.
My responsibility, or my team's responsibility, was to design the car.
Right.
It was Michael's team that really developed the transformed
piece,
Bumblebee.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, you know, we had to share a lot of data back and forth. But, you know, our whole deal was we had to design and build like four of those vehicles because, I mean, with the first movie, I think they totaled the first one like the first day of filming.
Oh, my word.
It was totally wrecked.
Oh.
And, you know, you're down to three, you know.
You're like, wait a second.
Michael.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. Well, okay, so all these different projects and several years of design and, you know, your leadership and all of that. You didn't just design cars. You actually led massive global teams, like global. How did you approach leading creative professionals across different cultures, continents, all of that?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing was I was – in the 100-year history of General Motors, I was just the sixth person to run design in all that, that history. And all my predecessors ran GM design in North America and had some influence in the global nature of the company because there were other design studios around the world, but they didn't report to the head of GM design.
Mm-hmm.
I convinced the leaders of the company that all of these studios around the world should work in collaboration as one global team.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had 11 studios around the world in 7 different countries.
Wow.
It was around 1,500 creative people. And we had all the wonderful virtual tools so I could, from my office or from our design center in Michigan where I lived, I could have reviews with the studios all over the world. It was great. You had live reviews with them and be home in time for dinner. But I felt as though the virtual tools only worked if I knew the people and if they really knew me.
Mm-hmm.
So I would visit those studios around the world on a very regular basis, put in a lot of air miles every year visiting these. But they knew me. I knew them, and I could tell when we were having a virtual review, I could hear it in their voice how they really felt about the design because I knew them.
Uh-huh.
I've had dinner with them. I've been out with them. I knew them. I knew their families, you know. Yeah, and that's what really made it work.
And what year, I mean, virtual reviews, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Hasn't been introduced to that until really, you know, COVID.
You know, I was at General Motors, really shows my age, for 44 years.
Wow.
And I started in 1972. Now, I became head of design in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
I ran it from 2003 to 2016.
Okay.
And we had those virtual tools that whole time.
At that point, yeah.
And we made sure that all those other studios around the world had the same tools so we could communicate well.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how you got recruited to GM? I know that you had reached out to them, right, initially, but then how did it finally come to fruition that not only were you with the company, but also rising through the ranks? And what challenges did you face?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah.
That's quite a bit.
Right?
That's quite a bit. Well, you
I
know,
think
okay,
it's poignant,
so,
though, you
yeah,
know? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I loved cars. Decided at age 8, I wanted to design cars for General Motors. You know, as a little kid, I was a slow reader. And my mother tried everything, special classes on Saturdays. That's how you spend my Saturdays, in special classes for reading. And she said, yeah, okay, this kid loves cars. I'll get him car magazines. Mm. And I had subscriptions to all these car magazines, 10 years old. And reading them cover to cover, I found out where that GM concept car came from. And age 11, I wrote a letter to General Motors.
Wow.
Telling them that when I grow up, I want to be a car designer. Is it engineering? Is it art? Is it math? What is it? And what do I need to do to become a designer? And, yeah, this is before emailing or anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a letter.
Right.
And I'll never forget my mother standing behind me while I was writing this letter. Wrote it, put it in the mail, and, you know, kept checking the mailbox every day, you know. And about a month later, it wasn't just a letter that came back, but it was a whole package, brochures and a letter and information about schools. And
they responded.
It was incredible.
In a big way. Yeah.
It became my roadmap
for
my career. And so.
Chills.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's like I was on a mission. And maybe I had tunnel vision. There may be some things I may have missed in life because of this whole mission I was on. But I applied to a number of schools of design when I was in high school. I was rejected by one school after another. And I was starting to think like this whole dream was starting to fade. And finally, my cousin suggested I apply to Howard University,
mm-hmm.
their College of Fine Arts.
Mm.
And that's where I ended up. And I majored in product design and sculpture. Mm. I felt as though automobiles, at least good-looking automobiles, are very sculptural
mm-hmm.
in their character. So mm-hmm. I wanted to learn sculpture as well. I continued to write letters to GM. And the gentleman I was writing to, Milo McNaughton was his name, and he was in HR. And he would send me a response, like once a year I write. And then he told me my junior year that they had an internship program. And I applied. I sent in two applications, one as a designer and one as a sculptor. They hired 10 designers and two sculptors for the summer. I was accepted. I got into the program. The program wasn't very well managed at GM, but it gave me an opportunity to continue to study design, to really watch the GM designers and what they were doing and learn from them. And at the end of that summer, I was called into the boss's office very last day, and they told me, you know, Ed, just go back and finish your senior year. We want to hire you.
Wow.
And, yeah, so, you know, I've never had a job interview, you know, so.
Oh, my
word. I went back and I, you know, finished my senior year and then went back to GM and started there as an entry-level rookie designer.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, you know, I'm like, now I'm in the deep end of the pool. I mean, these designers are so good. They were so good. And they were very helpful. You know, I'm the rookie, and they were trying, you know, they were very helpful.
Yeah. So how did you climb through the ranks, and what challenges did was there ever a point that you were like, this isn't the company, or this isn't the team, or whatever?
I say never worked a day in my life. I absolutely loved what I was doing.
That's awesome.
At all levels, you know. Entry-level designer, you know, they give the rookie the assignment to design the tail lamp for a car. You know, that's it. And as you move up, you're given more responsibility. The thing is, for each studio, each department, there'll be like five designers. And we're all sketching, competing, and putting our sketches up on a big display board. And you sign your sketch in a very legible way so everyone knows whose sketch it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of intimidating to put your sketch up on a wall with these great designers. You know, you put your sketch up along with them, and the bosses come in and look and look, and they're looking for the answer, and your name is there. I mean,
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right out there in front of everyone. There was a point in my career where I was not an executive, because, you know, you have several levels of salary designers, and then there are multiple levels of executive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right in the doorstep to the executive, entry-level executive. Mm-hmm. And everyone thought I'd be the next executive designer, you know, chief of one of the studios. And my supervisor, and I think he was really trying to be helpful, told me that, you know, you're doing a great job. You're designing all these cars, you know, your success rate is just so high. But, you know, and this is back in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
General Motors will never make an African-American an executive in design.
Wow.
So you've got a big decision to make. You need to decide if you're going to stay here at the level you're at for the rest of your career or work someplace else.
Wow.
And, you know.
What did you do with it? How did that sit with you?
I felt like I had been.
I would be.
I had just been.
Something hit. I can't say on air.
Yeah. I felt like I had just been hit by Joe Frazier. I don't know.
You know,
it was, you know, my head was just spinning, you know, and it took me a while to kind of clear my head, you know, like a couple weeks. And you know, I loved what I was doing at the level I was at.
Yeah.
But I knew that I could do more. And my peers knew that I could do. My peers thought, you know, I mean, he's going to be the next, you know, chief designer.
So what did you do? Did that just give you?
I just kept pushing, kept doing what I did best, and that was design. To design, to work in collaboration, to, you know, work with others. And I think that was a big part. You know, I think I was a good designer. I may not have been the absolute superstar designer. I thought I was good, but, you know, not necessarily superstar. But I was great at working with people and getting people who normally don't work well together to work together. And about a year later, I was promoted.
That's awesome. That is, I mean, my goodness. And then
from there, I just, moved up.
Yeah. I mean, not only did you become vice president and work on really cool projects like The Beast, you know, and Transformers, but, you know, worked cross-functionally across, you know, all those different teams. Wow. It sounds like, you know, that definitely empowered you to approach to the next level. That's awesome. Your leadership style has been described as both demanding and deeply supportive. How would you define your leadership philosophy?
I laugh when you say that because, you know, when Michael Bay gave me a cameo part in the fourth movie, I was supposed to be this leader of design and to come into this room where Mark Wahlberg were and a couple other actors and yell at them, you know. And
yell at them.
Yeah, and yell at them.
Do tell. How did that happen?
Because they had messed up what they were doing, and I'm supposed to come in and yell at these guys.
Oh, I remember from the movie. Yes.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So I said, you know, I don't yell.
You don't.
Yeah. And Michael Bay said, what? You know, he stopped him. And it's like everyone just kind of turned and looked. I said, I don't, He said, well, what do you do when you're, man, somebody really screws up something in the studio? What do you do? You know? I said, I don't have to yell to get my point across.
That's right.
You know? And if it's really something bad, I just say, you know, why don't you meet me in my office and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
And that was really the last thing they wanted to hear.
Well, I have to say, remembering the movie though, you did a good job, and you said that, and it wasn't. It was you delivered it. You could have gotten an Academy
and he loved it when I did it because you know he said, okay, well, use that line, you know. So I ended up after around the sixth take, maybe more than that. I was yelling it at the actors, you know, and it worked.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. You've mentored countless designers who are now leaders themselves. What do you believe great mentors owe the next generation? And what advice do you give leaders nowadays? Because we are in a different world for sure.
Yeah, we are. But, you know, being a bully is not, you know, the path to success.
I love that.
it is not the path to success. I think treating people the way you would want to be treated mm-hmm. is the way to go. And to spend time with people, to, you know, just talk your way through any issues. And I would start my day having coffee. I go down to the shops, not where the executives were, but I go down to the shops where United Auto Worker guys were building parts and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'd have coffee in the morning. Mm. And I'd find out from them what was really going on.
On the front line.
You know, and so I go down there, have coffee. Besides, they had the best coffee in the GM design. And I start there, and then I go back to my office and maybe have a call with the chairman of General Motors. But I would always start down in the shops. And not forgetting where you started, I think it's important.
Yeah. Over the years, you've received numerous industry honors and awards. Which recognition meant the most to you and why?
That's a very good question. I think, you know, because being in the Automotive Hall of Fame, you know, with the legends of the auto industry, that's a really big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when I received that recognition, it was huge. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, Henry Ford's and all of these great leaders. When I was inducted into the Corvette Hall of Fame, it's kind of interesting because my whole career I knew of, you know, there's this great rotunda where the Corvette Museum is, and they have these large banners of all of these people they have honored over the years. And, you know, as a designer coming up, you know, I just thought it was great and it would be cool to be there, but I never dreamed that my banner would ever be up there.
Hmm.
Because I just didn't take that for granted. I never took anything for granted, really, mm-hmm. in my entire career. And that was certainly one. But the day that I was being inducted, earlier in the day, I walked through that museum. And I didn't think the banner would be up yet, you know. And I'm walking through and I'm looking at the banners and smiling. And all of a sudden, I saw my banner. It was already up there.
Wow.
And it just, I mean, it just rocked me because it was unexpected. I didn't see that.
Did that hold special weight, or did you feel a heightened sense of responsibility as being the first African American and VP of global design? Like,
it did. Yes, you know, at every step of my career, I was the first African American. I was first African American hired at GM to design cars. And then moving, every level moving up, it was always a first. I didn't really dwell on it
mm-hmm.
that much, although it didn't take long after I started that I realized I was representing more than myself.
Yeah.
Because everyone wanted to know what I could do, not just because I was a new designer, but because I was African American. And what can he do as a designer? And there are certain assumptions of what I could do or what type of vehicle that I would be best suited at.
Yeah. Sage advice, really, for any leader.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
Ed, this has been nothing short of inspiring. Your career reminds us that design is more than lines and curves. It's leadership, courage, culture, and vision. You didn't just help shape vehicles. You helped shape an industry and the people within it. Thank you for blazing trails, breaking barriers, and showing us what's possible when creativity meets conviction. And to our listeners, if this conversation inspired you, challenged you, or made you see the road a little differently, be sure to share and join us next time on Trailblazers, where bold ideas and bold leaders leave their mark. Until next time, keep blazing your own trail.